From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor. Voices and stories from a warm, wet planet. Today, artificial intelligence, AI. To translate voices or access your bank account, to select targets to bomb and someone to kill, along with thousands of others.
It's the same kind of technology that unlocks my cell phone, the facial recognition software that I use. I find that really handy. If I need to make a bank transfer, I use it to unlock my phone. But this is also the same kind of thing that can be integrated into a surveillance drone. That surveillance drone uses that facial recognition software to select and execute targets on battlefields.
In occupied Palestine, Israeli soldiers target everyone, everywhere, in children's theaters, no less.
They target everything related with the life. They target the Freedom Theater, they target the youth center, they target the road, the streets, they destroy it. They target the trees. They target the cars. They destroy everything. What's happened with the Freedom Theater? They bombed the doors of the stage. They change it to be like arrested center.
This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Before dropping a few AI bombs, a request. Help us deliver this weekly package of Earth news. Subscribe at greenplanetmonitor.net. Days have passed since the deadly events of October 7th. Israel's retaliatory assault, Operation Iron Swords, has been way deadlier. 80 days into its bombing campaign, hearkening memories of Dresden, Cologne, and Hamburg, the Jewish state has dropped an estimated 25,000 tons of ordnance on the tiny enclave, among the most densely populated in the world, already crippled by 18 years of Israeli siege. Among Israel's 22,000 targets, hundreds of residential buildings, power targets, the Israelis call these, huge casualty numbers. Over 20,000 dead, half of them children and infants. Countless more are buried under the rubble. 53,000 Gazans have been injured and 1.9 million displaced, now cold, starving, and many of them ill. Sound brutal? You bet. Also, very intelligent. Israel has an artificially intelligent targeting system. The Gospel, it's called. Pioneers in mass surveillance, Israeli intelligence units have oceans of terabytes to feed it. Countless hours of drone and satellite footage, intercepted communications, personal data up the yin-yang. Gospel spits out targets like there's no tomorrow, from 50 a year to 100 a day. It even calculates collateral damage. Nothing happens by accident, an IDF source told Israeli journalists. When a three-year-old girl is killed, it's because someone decided it wasn't a big deal, a price worth paying in order to hit someone else. To learn more about AI-based warfighting systems like Israel's Orwellianly named Gospel and their sinister connection to social media and domestic policing, the GPM traveled to Utrecht, here in the Netherlands, home base for the Realities of Algorithmic Warfare project. Jessica Dorsey and Lauren Gould are project leaders. Dennis Janssen is a PhD candidate in the Department of Media and Culture Studies. The first voice you'll hear, Lauren Gould. Jessica and Dennis follow.
The Realities of Algorithmic Warfare project came from this insight that the automation or making certain weapon systems increasingly autonomous through algorithms and machine learning reinforces certain patterns, and we want to, as a program, investigate not only how these systems are innovated through the military and the machines they work with, but also look at how they're deployed in what theatres of war, and really importantly, what impact they have, like again, on civilian harm, but also on democratic control. A lot of people reflect on the human-machine interaction, so the interaction between militaries and these technologies, but very few traced like the kill chain all the way down to actually the theatres of war in which they're being implemented, which we now see, of course, the Israeli military using AI weapon systems in Gaza and the detrimental effect that has on civilians.
What is this system again? What's the name of this system, that the AI system the Israelis are developing, that's aimed at cooking up targets?
They refer to it as the gospel. Mm-hmm. So we could do a whole discourse analysis of how these particular projects are named. This is a system that through reporting we found out that it essentially wades through a mass amount of data that's been collected by the Israelis over the years on Palestinians in order to generate lists of targets, people against whom lethal force can be used, deployed. Before this system was integrated into their war fighting, they came up with approximately 50 targets per year. And what this AI system purportedly does is come up with something like hundreds of targets per day. And they do claim to make decisions, that the humans are still making the decision to fire the weapon. However, the scale and the speed at which this AI generates targeting lists and that the Israelis act upon it, this is the real game changer that we're seeing. The scale and the speed is something we've never seen before in warfare. We term this automation bias, and that is something where it's essentially the computer has generated this. I don't have enough time to really look through it. I will just defer to the computer's calculations or the algorithm's suggestion. And civilians are the ones bearing the brunt of these decisions.
So we have in place a lot of surveillance systems. Now, these surveillance systems could entail drone footage, also can entail satellite imagery, metadata from telephones, online search behavior of individuals. And what happens is through these algorithms, what they do is try to predict human behavior and sentiment and say, okay, based on all this data, this person is a legitimate target. The computer says yes. There is often still a human in the loop saying, okay, the computer says yes, therefore we'll push the button to trigger an attack. However, the speed at which these targets are presented and the speed at which the human is reacting really illustrates that there is very little human meaningful control over looking into what data was used and what was being predicted in a very careful, systematic way. So that's the role of the algorithm. Once a building is targeted, nobody of the military goes to that building and starts identifying, okay, you're obviously a Hamas leader, you were a civilian, you were a civilian, no, 10 other civilians. Ooh, you know, now we've sacrificed 300 civilians for one Hamas leader. That's, you know, not in any way in line with the rules of law or rules of engagement. Therefore, we need to, you know, adapt this algorithm and this machine learning system so it does better next time. That actually doesn't happen in war. So in its design, it's already very questionable whether this would ever be able to target the right people because it doesn't have that feedback loop.
Promoters of these technologies, I think many of them say that AI and machine learning will make target selection and actual targeting much more discriminated and specific and less violent. Barack Obama came to be known as the bomber in chief. And I mean, nobody had ever used drones as often as Barack Obama did in his strikes in Iraq and Syria and elsewhere.
Well, I think you have pinpointed a beautiful example. Obama also admitted that the machinery of the unmanned drone, there's a wonderful quote that it made people feel like it wasn't war anymore. And this comes to your idea of the ludification of war.
What do we mean by that term, ludification or ludification of war?
How do you pronounce it? It's Dennis's term.
I see that term and I think it's a Luddite. Luddites don't like technology.
But ludifiers really, really do like technology very much. Yeah, so it's ludification because it comes from making something ludic, so making it more playful. Very often when I'm talking to people about this, they'll say, oh, you mean the gamification of warfare? Which is, okay, that's a fine term, but I try to sort of broaden it up a little bit, because usually when people talk about gamification, it becomes very much about, well, indeed, this idea of drone warfare no longer being war anymore. Indeed, it's more like you're either watching or playing a video game, you know, from a distance, detached, just pushing a button and the kill happens thousands of miles away from you. And of course, the interfaces that you operate these kinds of technologies with, looking or feeling very video game console-like. So, for instance, a lot of loitering munitions or kamikaze drones, as they're sometimes called. So basically just a guided bomb with a camera on it that an infantry soldier can just launch on their own are often controlled with what basically looks like a Nintendo Switch. They've just got a little screen and they've got joysticks on the end of it, on both ends of it. So that's part of it. But it becomes a little bit broader than that. Also, for instance, in the way that these technologies are, as we've mentioned, sort of innovated with or experimented with, that itself also tends to have this sort of playful element in it where, as I like to say, failure becomes a productive force, so to say. So you're taking these out into a field exercise, or you're just taking them out onto the streets of your military base, and you're controlling it with your little gamepad and you're trying out maneuvers and trying to see, for instance, what that does to the sort of cognitive load of a soldier operating this. Is he able to control the vehicle and also still keep up with the people around him? This too has to me a sort of a playful element to it, where the same risk also looms where, oh, we're just experimenting with this. We're just trying out what it can do. It's not really part of war. But in the meantime, of course, this is being funded by taxpayer money, and the actual application of these things is still very much a war-fighting activity. Mm-hmm. And the risk of this sort of experimental attitude also risks kind of like losing that connection to the seriousness of war, I would say. Very generally speaking, the big drone platforms are still being developed by very traditional defense companies. So, you know, the MQ-9 Reaper is one by General Atomics, and loitering munitions are getting developed by Air Environment. And tech companies tend to be more involved, if you can make a hard distinction already between classic defense companies and tech companies, because they are themselves already becoming more and more militarized. For example, the American Department of Defense gets more interested in collaborating with companies like Google and Amazon and these kinds of places. But they tend to be more involved with the development and innovation of modular technologies, software. So Project Maven is a really great example of this, where Google's image processing platform was being used by the Department of Defense to process their image data that they gather with their global surveillance systems and drones and all these kinds of things.
So there's a synergy between the civilian uses of artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Very much so, yeah. It's actually a very difficult problem that this sort of what we call dual use aspect of AI is so pervasive. Very often, what you see is that things that get developed in the civilian sphere are very close to being applicable already in the military sphere. Project Maven is a great example of this, I think.
All these surveillance technologies, so the data that's being used to now feed into war practices is the same data that we produce ourselves as citizens, right? It's the data, mm-hmm. our search behavior on Google or our social media posts, our, you know, telephone conversations. The militaries involved and their partners, the big tech companies involved in developing these technologies, are also developing them and testing them on us. So, for example, the Dutch military was so eager to develop AI possibilities and to develop these capabilities to sift through large amounts of data and make them actionable based on algorithms. What they did is during COVID set up a team that tracked the sentiment and behavior of Dutch citizens in name of the crisis, the COVID crisis, to predict where there might be civil unrest. And then they sold these predictions to the police. And these civil unrests were anti-COVID protests, but also Black Lives Matter protests and protests against 5G, for example. Now, this was against all privacy regulation. The military is not allowed to collect data on citizens within its own borders. So they did so, you know, out of the public eye and against all privacy regulation. Now, this ultimately, the wonderful work of investigative journalists brought this to the public eye and political debate. There was a huge uproar in Parliament, and ultimately this centre was stopped, and research was done and said this was illegal, this was not allowed. Now, it was really interesting to see what the military's response to this was, saying we need to change the laws.
It's the same kind of technology, just to give some concrete examples, that unlocks my cell phone, the facial recognition software that I use. I find that really handy. If I need to make a bank transfer, I use it to unlock my phone. But this is also the same kind of thing that can be integrated into a surveillance drone, and then that same surveillance drone gathers the data, processes it, and then uses that facial recognition software to select and execute targets on battlefields. Yeah. So to understand that those kinds of examples, the same goes for a large language model. So the ChatGPT that many of us are experimenting with or using to maybe draft some emails, or college students are using it to perhaps help them in their essay writing. That kind of stuff, when integrated by, for example, Palantir, in their AI platform.
What's Palantir?
Palantir is a corporation based in the US that is very much in the field of using AI and algorithmic innovation to help defense departments around the world, the US, but also others, in their targeting process. And I think that this large language model is the ChatGPT we're all using, but then fed with data from classified and open intelligence sources in order to help speed up and intensify battlefield decision making.
Palantir actually promotes itself as saying powering AI assisted decision making from war zones to factory floors. So you can really see how these commercial companies, sometimes they start as startups and then develop into big companies like Palantir. Others are already very established within Silicon Valley, like Google. So you have the classic military-industrial complex, but we've referred to it in a recent publication as the military-industrial commercial complex. The classic industrial complex produces the hardware, and the commercial is very much the software and kind of what they call the bloodline of targeting processes. So the CEO of Palantir is gone to Ukraine and announced that Palantir are involved in nearly all Ukraine's targeting processes. What's really interesting to look at the history of these companies and their roles in previous security arenas. For example, Palantir and another close, well-known startup called Clearview were companies that were first collaborating in policing operations in the US. And they said, look, we can make the streets safer, your community safer, because through the surveillance technologies that we have, we can trace and predict criminal behavior and help police arrest criminals even before they've actually engaged in a criminal act, and therefore create more security. And that they would do so with between 96 and 99% accuracy. What happened in reality was that mostly Black and brown neighborhoods were surveilled. People were wrongly targeted, wrongly arrested. They were seen by their communities because they were arrested as criminals, and they therefore experienced a huge amount of harm Now, thankfully, in the context of the US, there was a lot of protest. There was a lot of lawyers representing them, ultimately to get them out of prison, but also to say these systems don't work. They're not doing what they're claiming to be able to do. And
this is what's called algorithmic bias.
Exactly, the algorithmic bias. Then the police stopped working with Palantir and Clearview. What they've done is rebranded themselves and said, okay, well, actually, we'll use the same technologies in the context of war. And now they're being heralded as great successes in Ukraine and other theatres of war.
Algorithmic warfare, by design, reduces humans and human behavior to data points. That's a dehumanization. Are we comfortable with that? That our militaries are removing themselves even further from the decision-making process when they take decisions that take human lives?
And these technologies are being developed. I mean, you know, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Gaza in the West Bank. These technologies are all being trialed, they're all being field tested in these arenas. And so, which brings to my mind this philosophical question, are these wars driving the technology or is the technology driving the wars? It seems like an absurd idea. I mean, these wars happen for all sorts of reasons, geostrategic, deeply flawed regional conflicts that are fed by, you know, ambition for power and economic, influence and all the rest of it. But they're all being fueled by these technologies.
Well, I think you've actually nearly directly quoted Keane, who says wars are not always about winning, but they are alternative systems of profit, power and protection. And I think this alternative systems of profit and power, when it comes to these technologies, is very key to understand that, yes, every war is a testing ground for new technologies. And we see this now in Ukraine. It's often been claimed that this is the AI-driven war. There is a lot of AI weapon systems with increasing autonomy being used and tested in Ukraine. We were just talking to another scholar involved in our program, and she was saying that in our network, somebody's been receiving lots of emails from Ukrainian soldiers saying everybody's talking about Gaza now, but we're using, you know, fully autonomous weapon systems. So absolutely, every war is a testing ground. There's nothing necessarily new about that. It's also every war is a means to get rid of old technologies. So in the Gaza situation, we see AI-driven targeting processes, but also that Israel is using really old-fashioned bombs that were used, you know, in Vietnam, and very heavy bombs. And also we had a report out just last week that CIA said about 40% of the bombs were actually not smart bombs, but dumb bombs. So in every war, we see also making space for new technologies by using old weapon systems. And also that in every war, other militaries are watching, right? So then we have this reinforcing mechanism afterwards that we see, you know, in the face of Ukraine, many NATO countries investing much more money in the military. In the Netherlands, it was 40 million, I think, in the wake of the start of the war in Ukraine. But also, for example, the Netherlands, its MQ Reapers were built and finished and their pilots trained. And in the face of the Ukraine war, they said, right, now we need to arm them with bombs, whereas before they said they would only be used for surveillance technology. So every war in itself reinforces and legitimizes the further militarization.
Is the development of these technologies, AI-based, machine learning-based warfighting technologies, is it self-propelling? The related question is about this, the technological imperative, that once you've got a set of technologies, there's no way to stop them from being developed. So is AI-based warfighting kind of inevitable? Is it the future form of warfighting? I mean, it is the form of warfighting now, largely.
Yeah, there's at least a very strong tendency towards it. Some people will say that the train has left the station and that you can't... We love this metaphor in our
hate
program.
It at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. We have a love-hate relationship with it. But the idea that indeed, like, oh, you can't halt the train anymore, it's going to come, and there seems to also be this policy perspective sort of developing that, oh, it's going to happen anyway. That means that we need to be involved in the development so that it goes in the sort of the right direction. And here's the question also of whether this development is sort of self-propelling. I would say that it seems that way, but it's usually driven, I think, by a lot of other factors, right? So geopolitical tensions, simply the development of communications, information technologies in other economic sectors, because as we've said, these technologies are very often dual use. So the military seems to mostly also be looking at what is happening externally and saying, we want to get in on that. Stay ahead. Our enemies are getting these weapons, and so must we. So a lot of this is threat perception and contestation over resources, geopolitical influence, etc. I would say that those things are ultimately more important in actually driving the integration of these technologies than the technological development itself. It's more that these things drive the development than the other way around.
I would intend to disagree.
Oh. it's not a very, very typical media scholarly thing to say, actually. If I were a real media scholar, I would say, no, it's the technology that drives itself.
I think it's I think it's always humans. Humans build technologies, right?
Yes.
So there are human interests involved in innovating, developing, deploying these technologies. And maybe if we go to the nuclear example, maybe many of the listeners have been to the Oppenheimer film, we see that actually what this film beautifully illustrates, there are very many different actors involved in building these weapon systems, right? We have the military themselves. Now, these weapon systems, they facilitate the shift to remoteness, but they also are a solution to the problem that, you know, militaries have a huge deficit and human beings that want to be part of the military, right? Mm-hmm. So they are turning to these technologies to fill their ranks with other means to still be able to wage war. So that's one of the interests of the militaries involved.
That there are a lot of technology wonks out there who they could attract into the ranks.
Okay, so they have to attract new type of people that may be willing to be part of this because they're not being deployed to theatres of war. But I think if you talk to the military, they'll say, we need these technologies because we just don't have any new members coming in, and therefore we have, a gap, a deficiency in our ability to wage war. So these technologies are to some extent a solution to that problem. Then you have, the startups and the big Silicon Valley corporations. They're, it's a huge money-making opportunity to collaborate with the militaries. There's big billion-dollar contracts on the line. They have also a interest in selling these technologies mm-hmm. as being the solution to the problem at hand, because it also it brings in major profits. We talked about the Palantir and Clearview example. They failed at a national policing level, so now they're selling themselves in the global context of war. And then there's the scientists. There's scientists that collaborate. There's the computer scientists that collaborate, because that also facilitates their career. What's happened now is a lot of people have been predicting how these technologies would be used and what level of destruction we would see. Now we're seeing it play out before our eyes. This is the moment for us to say, look, we've been predicting this would be one of the outcomes of using these technologies, namely you make killing more systematic, quicker, and therefore much more destructive. Is this really what we want in warfare? What kind of societies produce these technologies? And sometimes the worst has to happen for people to wake up to understand the consequences of particular weapon systems. And we have seen, with nuclear weapon systems, other weapon systems where we've said, we as humanity or we as a society do not want to have this being used in our name. So we have to learn from those contexts and also continue to bring in these realities to contest some of the master narratives about precision and accuracy.
Lauren Gould is Assistant Professor of Conflict Studies at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. Jessica Dorsey is Assistant Professor of International and European Law and a member of the Open Source Global Justice Investigations Lab. Dennis Janssen is a PhD candidate in the Department of Media and Culture Studies with an interest in ludification, playfulness among Dutch military innovators. For more information about AI-based warfare and the realities of Algorithmic Warfare Project, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. With your help, we'll keep delivering stories about planet Earth, human development, justice, and science to listen to, read, and watch. AI-based targeting system spares nothing and no one. Missile strikes and 2,000-pound bombs reduce mosques and churches to rubble, along with fishing boats, journalists' headquarters, and cultural centers. Over in the West Bank, 5 minutes from Gaza, on the wings of an F-35, boots on the ground do the door smashing. On the night of December 12th, in the besieged city of Jenin, IDF troops broke into Jenin's renowned Freedom Theater, ransacking and vandalizing its rooms and stage, as Israeli soldiers are wont to do, before moving on to the homes of its extensively surveilled directors. Ahmed Tabassi was released the next day. General Manager Mustafa Shetta remains in detention, reportedly in Megiddo in northern Israel, where most of Israel's 8,000 political prisoners are held. Under Article 76 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, occupying powers like Israel are required to detain prisoners inside occupied territory. Israel routinely flouts the convention with complete impunity. I spoke with Mustafa Shetta last July. Here is our conversation. Hello, Mustafa Shetta. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor. Can you introduce yourself? Tell me who you are and where you are and what you do.
My name is Mustafa Shetta. I am from Jenin City, and I work as the general manager of the Freedom Theater in Jenin refugee camp.
And you are in Jenin right now?
Yeah, I live in Jenin. Yeah, I'm in Jenin now. I am in my home during the military operations out of the camp now, where is the Israel forest and the army, they attack the camp in this moment.
Can you tell me what the Freedom Theater is?
Okay, the Freedom Theater, it's a cultural organization, but it's based on the heritage from Arna Mer. She's a Jewish woman. She came to Jenin to establish this creative center to help the Palestinian from the first Intifada. We talk about 89 to establish a center to help the children for their expression. In that time, Israel closed the school, and Arna came to Jenin to establish the childhood centers in Jenin and Jenin refugee camp. Later, her son, Giuliano, he joined her mother to establish the first theater in Jenin. It was called the Stone Theater in the middle of Jenin refugee camp. But during the invasion, Jenin invasion happened in 2002, it's destroyed by Israel. Then Giuliano returned with his film, Arna Children, to make documentary about what mother did. And depending on this film, he decided to return to Jenin and reestablish again theater in Jenin refugee camp and give it title The Freedom Theater from 2006. The Freedom Theater, it's like cultural organization, but it's more than this. It's cultural, social, and political movement where we focus for raise the critical and brave voice against to monitor and evaluate the situation in Palestine. We raise the title of or the concept of cultural resistance and work under this title in our work. We have more than 45 professional production. We have here at the Freedom Theater, the only performing arts school in Palestine, where we give this opportunity for the talent young people in Jenin and in the north of West Bank and for the Palestinian from 48 to learn what means theater, how they can be professional actor. And besides that, the child and youth program, where we work with the children and the youth and the women in in Jenin area, and we depend on that. We have yearly Kids for Kids play, and we work with the people, with the kids and their parents, for their mental health, for something related with their exit in Palestine.
And there's actually a facility, there is a theater, a building in the refugee camp in Jenin. The Freedom Theater has a facility in the refugee camp?
Yeah, we are based in Jenin refugee camp. Already we rent the place from the youth center, and we are usually, we have like different activities. Recently already we finished our summer camp, and we continue our production with the different people. So yeah, we have all the ability to be there, and the people already, where they stand with us already, as what I said, we are from here. I mean, we are from this area. So we are work together. We're proud of this place, how it's created, how we continue, and for everything.
Now, in this most recent incursion of the Israeli military into Jenin refugee camp, have they targeted the Freedom Theater?
When we talk about what they target, what Israel army target this in our area, they target everything related with the life. I mean, they target the Freedom Theater, they target the youth center, they target the road, the streets, they destroy it. They target the trees, they target the cars, everything. They destroy everything. The idea about what's happened with the Freedom Theater, that they destroy, they bomb the doors, the doors of the stage, and they open the door of the stage of the Freedom Theater, and they change it to be like arrested center, because they bring all the young people and the youth from the camp and put it in the stage and make investigation with them. Then that's the attack. They attacked us by this way, and they changed the yard of the Freedom Theater to be like a military zone for their jeeps, for their forests, for their groups. And until this moment, they occupied all the area with the buildings, guest house, and the theater office, and the theater stage. It's occupied by them now. I mean, until this moment, they are there. They are based, their military there in our theater.
So at this moment, as we speak, we're speaking now on July 4th in the morning, the Israeli military, the IDF, have occupied the facilities of the Freedom Theater.
Yes.
What's the situation in Jenin right now?
It's really hard. You know, we live in the war situation, we can say. Israel attacked us from different area, and from the ground, from the sky, drones in the sky, the jeeps, military jeeps all the time. They came and moved in different area. But they make a siege, especially they targeted the center of the refugee camp, where they make a big siege around it. They try to catch the fighters, or maybe kill them, maybe arrested them. We don't know. But until this moment, they talk about different goals, 10 points of their goals, and we don't know what exactly that means. I mean, we expect something maybe will be more worse later.
And how many Palestinians have been injured? How many have been killed?
Today, we talk about 10 persons that are killed. We talk about around 100 persons that are injured.
And are these, who are these people? Are they militants who are fighting? Or are they everybody? Like the civilians, men, women, children, who's been injured? And how have they been injured?
They are not military. They are not military. They are young people. They are youth. They killed them during their attack. Some of them, they are through stones sometime. The idea of the attack, when the people, they just want to check, for example, to explain what's going on around them. They target them by snipers. They use snipers all the time when they attacked us. So the number of the people, we'll talk about people between 18 to 25, they are killed in this operation, in this days.
And there are Israeli snipers on the roofs of the refugee camp?
Yeah, they occupied all the buildings, the high buildings, and they put their snipers there, and they targeted all the persons already. Maybe they are being here or there sometime. I mean, it's not about just the fighters. It's about everything. It's about any person he just moved. As maybe in the TV, sometimes they destroy the doors of the hospitals. They destroy the cars. They did everything against the human being, the life. in general.
They destroyed the doors of the hospital.
Yeah, the big doors of the hospital this morning.
This is a hospital within the refugee camp?
It's government hospital. It's close to the Jenin refugee camp, but with their bulldozer, they destroy it during their move and come and move in the front of the hospital.
And have they occupied the hospital? Have troops gone into the hospital?
No, they don't occupy the hospital, but they make the situation for the ambulance. It's really hard. They don't allow for them to check for the injured in the camp. They don't allow for them to move by freeway. They all the time stop them. They check all the time, check what they have in the car, in their ambulance. And that makes the life or the situation and the process of the work for the medical help, it's really hard in this moment.
And there are drones overhead.
Yes.
Tell me about that. I mean, it's a very uncanny, horrible experience to hear the buzzing of a drone over your head. But are there drones flying overhead regularly over Jenin?
They use that for to talk, not just the drones. It's not just to take photo or to cover something. It's like, you know, it's like intelligence. It came here to target the people with the rocks, small rocks, and they killed some people. Recently, before 10 days, they killed three persons in Jenin by drones. So it's occupied the sky. I mean, all the time you hear the noise and the voice and of those drones in our sky. So we are worried when we hear about the drones above us. That means we are in a dangerous situation, you know.
And there are helicopters. Are there jet fighters? Are there helicopters?
They use sometimes Apache, but in this operation they don't use it until this moment. They threat us to use Apache and F-16 and the tanks, but until this moment we are lucky they don't use it until this time.
I mean, it's a war zone right now in Jenin. Are you able to go outside? Are you able to go shopping?
No. It's all the markets. It's closed now. No one move. Already they give us sometime 1 hour just to move to check for the markets. I mean the local and the neighbor markets. Sometime you have some friends or people already open small markets in some neighborhood. We move through the doors, through the houses to reach for something. But it's a closed. It's like refuge. No one can move. Any person he move, he put himself in very dangerous situation because he don't know what he can discover. And this morning, I discovered the Israel army in the front of my home. So I expect why they are came to me. They came to me or what for what? But I prepare myself. I prepare myself. Maybe if they want to arrest me, to be just ready. But it's okay because they are just came here to make some survive and they are moved. So we expect all the time there is something will happen. There is something worse may will be happen. For example, they arrested my colleague Adnan Nagnari. He's the technician of the Freedom Theater because they attacked his home and they arrested him. My colleague Ahmed Toubassi, the artistic director of the Freedom Theater, he's from the camp. He can't stay in his home, so they decide to move in the night through the ambulance and through the Red Cross, and that's really difficult. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like the people when they are just moved in 48, that like the refugees, how they move from their houses and their homeland in 48, in Nakba. We talk about in Nakba, how it's like that. It's the same situation. And we are faced now in this time, like what's happened in 2002. In 2002, Jenin refugee camp was the main battle of the struggle between the Palestinian fighters and Israel. We return to repeat the same situation. Israel, unfortunately, until this moment, they don't understand how they can find solution. The solution does not come by military forces came to Jenin and attacked and killed the people. The solution is by end the problem. The problem by end the occupation. It's clear, it's logic. I mean, the idea about how we can continue to find solution, not continue to blood and lose the people. The idea by end the occupation and give the people their rights.
Of course, the Israeli government position is that it is trying to weed out terrorists, quote unquote, and the international community, quote unquote,
starting with the United States. The United States, the Biden administration has said that it supports Israel entirely. It supports Israel's incursion into Jenin entirely, that Israel has the right to defend itself.
I heard what the U.S. government said and the U.K. government said in this morning. It's immoral. It's not really, it's something really not good, not, it's really bad. They said, we respect Israel, protect themselves, and we accept that. And they asked the two parties to calm down. I don't know what they need from us, how we can calm down. We are under attack. Sometimes it's something really silly when they ask the people under incubation and under punishment to be silent, don't cry, don't be angry, and you must be silent all the time. So this is not logic, and that's really clear. This imbalance, a relationship between the people here, the international community, and how they look for the situation here, like what's going on when they talk about Ukraine, for example. About the occupation, the Russian occupation, the Ukrainian resistance. And we talk about that later. We respect the Ukrainian resistance. We support that because we don't hope to find any people in the world to be under occupation, sure, because we have this experience. But we ask the people, if you consider you respect and recognize the resistance in Ukraine, please consider we are here as a human. We have the same condition. We are under occupation. It's Israeli occupation, and we have resistance. And you must recognize we are follow the international community, the international law. Why you don't consider us part of the world? Sometimes, you know, this is the problem. Sometimes with the U.S. and later they ask why the world they hate U.S. I don't know. It's clear they hate U.S. because you did something bad.
The various factions, Mustafa Shetta, the various factions, militant factions, and political factions with their militant wings in Jenin are collaborating. Hamas, Islamic Jihad, they're all working together. They're all collaborating.
Yeah. I mean, all the Palestinian parties and all the military wings, now they are work together. From the last 2 years, the Palestinians themselves, they have a problem with their leadership, you know, with Abu Mazen, with the Palestinian government. They don't trust on them, including the Palestinian parties. I mean, the people, they can't, accept all these years with a miserable situation, without any hope, without any future. So the young people from the camp, already they're born in 2002 during the invasion. Now they are the leaders. They have like a critical voice about everything around them. So they decide, yes, they have different ideological. I mean, they have different ideological about the situation, about the life. Some of them, they are communists. They don't, believe in communists and the socialists. Some people, they are believe in the Islamic State or Islamic movement. Some of them, they are close to national movement or national issues. But they decide to be together. They decide to have one weapon, to fight one enemy. And they decide this enemy will be the incubation. So that put all of them in one space to have the common idea about Palestine and about the struggle in general.
And it must be, I know it is, incredibly difficult to organize if you're a militant in a place like Jenin, because the Israeli military and Shin Bet, they've got everybody's phone numbers, they've got everybody's photographs, they know where everybody lives. When they go into Jenin, they know exactly which buildings they're targeting.
Exactly, yes. They sent me message. They told me, don't be part of any action in Jenin. We will arrest you. They threatened me.
You got a text message from Shin Bet?
Yeah, they threatened me. They told me, don't be part of anything. If you be part, we will arrest you. Maybe they don't have it. Sometimes they don't happy with what we said in the news, with the agencies. We talk about what's going on about Palestine. And they told us, you don't say the truth all the time. You make something else. I mean, you give some another image, or it's the opposite of the reality. They target everything here. They target any person. He have the voice or raise the voice. And this is the problem. So they know everything. They follow us, they run around us, and they try to catch any person. He just have Something different, and he tried to make something some activities or something different, in fact.
So how do people organize themselves under such incredibly powerful surveillance and oppression?
Inside the camp, the leadership, it's like common leadership. It's like no one leader. I mean, they have like a committee together. They decide about everything. They protect themselves within the houses in the camp. And they are the majority of them, they are already from the camp. I mean, their families there, their relatives there. So they organize themselves without return to any high leaders out of the camp to take decision or to make something. They decide about what they have by themselves directly, daily, without any agenda out of the camp. So that helped them, in fact, to continue until this moment. We hope for them to be safe, out of the killing, because now we expect Israel, they will make another crazy process and the operation inside the camp and after this, maybe for the next hours. So we hope for them to be safe. I think they don't, our people, our fighters, they don't have this experience. They are not, I mean, be part of training, military training before, to be like real soldiers. But they use what they know about the natural of their place, the geographic, and about what they know. They depend on their belief sometime for their right to fight and all of that issue.
And where do Palestinian security forces, the security forces of the Palestinian Authority, fit into all this?
I don't know what I can say. Maybe I can just put my head there. No voice for them. Just yesterday, Abu Mazen and the government, they decide to have meeting after 10 hours, not 10 hours, after around 20 hours of the Israel attack Jenin, to say, we are feel sorry. We ask the international community to ask Israel to stop their invasion. We are really feel bad from the American position. And they ask us to survive and to continue in the struggle. But they are not part of that. I mean, they don't allow for any person, any Palestinian security, member of the security advice, to be part of this, because that's not allowed for them in general. So their military zone for the Palestinian Authority, there is no one there. You don't have any voice there.
And Abbas has just said that he's going to end security cooperation, which makes me laugh. I mean, how many times has he said, we're going to end security cooperation? Like, geez, haven't you already ended security cooperation? You're saying now you're going to...
Who care about that? No one care about that. Look, in Jenin City, in those last two years, no one already respect this authority already. No one listen to that authority. I mean, if what he want to say, that's not important for us as a people in Jenin. It's about this government. It's not have the power because they don't have the trust from the people. I mean, no one yesterday wait Abu Mazen's speech. In fact, no one. We hear about that in the social media. It's just like a joke, you know. Hey, what Abu Mazen said? He said, I will end the security cooperation with Israel. Wow. Thank you. Wow. That's great action. But in general, really, to be honest, no one care about that. We don't think the Palestinian Authority can invest in this or can be involved in this action in Jenin. Now, but we know at the same time that means that's what us alone in our area. Not just Abu Mazen, by the way, including Hamas in Gaza. Hamas, they said, if they pass through the red line, we will stop them. We don't know what means red line. All the people ask, what's the red line? They killed us, they attacked us, but we don't know what's the red line. What that mean? The two authorities in Gaza or in Ramallah or in Gaza, they just give us speech and titles without any action in the ground.
Do activists and militants in Jenin have an analysis or a program for the future? Do they have a position on the two-state model versus the one-state model?
You talk about the fighters in the camp?
Yeah, the fighters, but not just. I'm talking about activists, political activists and as well as militants, do they have a feeling about whether or not the two-state solution is dead and there should be a single democratic state? Do they take a position on this?
David, recently, I consider myself part of those activists in general. Recently, all the speech talk about one state. No one talk about two states. All the speech talk about one state. And here we talk about how we can work together for that. It's not with the Jewish or Israeli people, by the way. I talk about the Palestinians themselves. Palestinians think about, it's not logic. What we can do all these years, we talk about two states, it's nothing happened. Nothing changed in the ground. So the idea why we don't return to the core of the conflict or the problem to talk about one state for all people. Yes, there's a problem with the, for example, Jewish or with the Israeli, we can't solve it. But we don't want to focus for something we can't achieve it. The two states, it's something we can't work here. Netanyahu himself recently he said, forget the solution of two states. But Netanyahu said that because he have one solution to transfer the Palestinians out of Palestine. For us, for me, I believe in that solution because I focus for right of return for the refugees to their original places. So that's different, you know, different opinion or different thinking about one issue.
Right now, Mustafa, can you hear bombs and guns and sounds? What are you hearing through your window?
I hear now from my window the drones in the sky.
You can hear drones?
Yes.
That must be a very scary feeling.
It's scary, but when you're scared sometimes, you are, what we can say, you scare one time, but later it will be like normal, you know, you deal with that. For sure, when I heard that in the beginning, oh, what's going on, what I can do, how I can protect myself, I will hit myself. But now it will be like normal, you know, we deal with that. It's dangerous, but what we can do, we need to continue in our life.
Are folks such as yourself in Jenin, in the refugee camp and outside the camp, but in Jenin, are you meeting? Are you talking? Are you organizing? Are you holding gatherings? Are you able to communicate? Are you able to discuss? Yeah, at this moment, in these days.
In these days, in fact, we can't meet any person because it's difficult. They divided the city and the camp. We can't meet each other by safe way and by in person. It's really hard and difficult. Just we make a call and contact with my colleagues, with the people, just to check about their condition, about their situation. But it's not about meeting. I have another meeting, for example, with the people outside of Palestine to ask for some project, artistic project or something, with the people from Europe, with the people from US. And I inform them we are in this situation and they are shared. The story of the Freedom Theater already we published in social media about my testimony, about what's happened, about Ahmad Touba. He makes some videos, talk about what's going on in Jenin. So we share that in this moment. I think, David, the Freedom Theater in this moment changed to be from the cultural organization to be like information center to inform the people about the situation and what's going on.
Mustafa Shetta is founding director and general manager of the Freedom Theater in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Shetta was arrested by Israeli soldiers on December 13th. He's now believed to be held in Megiddo prison inside Israel and will reportedly face a military court in the coming days. His chances of acquittal are virtually nil. The charges he faces are unknown. Such is the nature of Israeli military justice in occupied Palestine. For more information about Mustafa Shetta and the Jenin Freedom Theater, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.